today. We're going to start with our normal two-minute meditation. Please repeat after me. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me. Good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
This one's called Accumulation. An opening in the storming sea, gold deposited on bones. Once accumulation has begun, take care not to interfere. There is a fable about a pious man whose father just died. The geomancer instructed the son to bury his father at the mouth of a sea cave. The sea opened at this spot only once in 100 years, and a family who utilized it would experience great fortune. Although he had misgivings about this unorthodox location, the son threw the casket into the waters at the indicated time. For weeks, the son doubted what he had done. He eventually went to a competing geomancer who, out of jealousy, advised his son to raise the casket. The son did so. When the coffin was brought up and opened, the man saw that a fine layer of pure gold had already been deposited on his father's bones, a clear indication of the auspicious transformation that had begun. In regret, the son wanted to throw the father back in, but it was too late. There was no remedy remedying what he had done. Spiritual practice must be uninterrupted. It may be anxious because we see very little happening on a daily basis, but we must be patient until we can see what the accumulation of our efforts yields. Self-cultivation means steady, gradual progress. To stop prematurely would be more disastrous than never having started at all.
Mm. I heard a man once say that the miracle of steps 6 and 7 happens in the actions of steps 8 and 9. I want to read something out of this book, The Spirituality of Imperfection, as it relates to these character defects. As the very concept of a higher power implies, spirituality is founded in the recognition and acceptance of one's being a finite creature. There is, of course, something wrong with us. Finite beings, we thirst for the infinite. Man is the creature who wants to be God, as Sartre sadly observed. But we are not God, and given our human nature, it's not, I'm okay, you're okay, but I'm not okay, and you're not okay, but that's all right. This presents a difficult challenge for the modern mind, which tends to view problems from the perspective, if it's wrong, it can be fixed. The corollary runs, if we cannot fix it, then there must be nothing wrong. But if nothing is wrong, then there is no need for spirituality. In a perfect world, there would be no spirituality at all. The perfect is the completed, that which is finished, ended. But because we are humans, we are not and cannot be finished or ended while we are still alive. Imperfection is related to limits. As humans, we do not have limits, we are limited. Something is wrong and it cannot be fixed. Whenever that reality of limitation is denied or rejected, our spiritual. In 1937 in New York and in 1939 in its other center, Akron, Ohio, Alcoholics Anonymous departed Oxford Group offices. Many factors weighed, but among the heaviest loomed the group insistence on their four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. These ideals are still mentioned in some AA groups, but co-founder Bill W. spoke for the fellowship as a whole in a 1940 letter in which he responded to a critic of AA's abandonment of the four absolutes. The ideals of purity, honesty, unselfishness, and love are as adhered to by members of Alcoholics Anonymous as by any other group of people. But we found that when you put the word absolute before them, alcoholics just couldn't stand the pace, and too many went out and got drunk again. As you so well understand, we drunks are all or nothing people. In the old days of the Oxford groups, they were forever talking about the four absolutes. There we saw people going broke on this sort of perfection, trying to get too good by Thursday. Finite beings who thirst for the infinite, desperate creatures who want to be God, all or nothing people who go broke on perfection, given our limitations and our tendency to strain against them, how do we learn to put up with ourselves? The sages and saints have not left us without some thoughts on the subject. The Desert Fathers, that marvelous group of imperfect human beings who struggle tirelessly with their own imperfections, discovered quite a bit about learning how to put up with ourselves. The secret, they determined, lies in compassion, which begins with putting up with other people. A monk was brought up before the Brotherhood for having committed a grievous sin, and it was decided that he would be excommunicated. As the monk left the sanctuary, his head bent in shame, the esteemed Abba Bessarion stood up, fell into step behind his fellow monk, and a clear voice announced, "I." The very solitude of their lives as hermits led the desert fathers that we, like others, not in our virtues and our strengths, but precisely in our faults, our defects, our shortcomings, our failings, and our sins. As Evagrius Ponticus, one of the most influential of the desert monks, put it, the nearer we draw to God, the more we should see ourselves as being one with every sinner. And I know the word sin brings up all kinds of connotations in your mind, perhaps religious overtones, but at the end of the day, it's about falling short and missing the mark. And I can report to you that after 14 years and 7 months, that the same defects I had when I showed up here around November 5th, 2007, are still with me today. They just don't, it's like in Bill's story when he refers to the sixth and seventh step, he says, my newfound friend, God, would take them away root and branch. I have different branches today, but at the root, they're still the same. I heard a guy at a weekend retreat I was attending years ago. He'd been sober 35 years at that time. He said that the same defects he had 35 years ago were still with him, except there was a difference. 35 years ago, those defects were large, roaring lions that were clawing at everybody that got near him. Now at 35 years, they've turned into these little kittens that purr next to his side. And they can get in and get out really quickly, and they're very sly and crafty. You know, I have examples of some defects that I had 14 and a half years ago that I still have today. 14 and a half years ago, I always thought my time was more important than anyone else's time. Okay, now I'm acutely aware of that defect, and I tend to be able to see it coming and pause and act in a different way. But I still see how it dominates me. My need to be important is still a part of what drives me every day. And in a way, it is fueling my capacity to sit up here in front of you over the course of the weekend and carry a message of depth and weight. It's a blameworthy trait at times when I use it in the wrong situations. And then there are other situations where it serves me well because it gives me the confidence to sit up here and carry this message in hopes that you might hear something that alters the course of your recovery, that you may make a decision and take some action that you may not have taken if Brandon and I hadn't rolled through town. And I'm not saying this from an egotistical place. It's what happened to me in 2009 when I was sitting at a retreat where you're sitting. It altered the course of my recovery because after I sat for an entire weekend and listened to this man and this woman, when I left, I said, there's so much more available to me than I thought before this weekend. That's what happened. That weekend in 2009, one of the big themes of that weekend was making your amends, all of them, A-L-L. Step 8, we made a list of all the people that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The word all, I think, means every one of them that we're able to contact and approach. And there was something in the process of making amends. My sponsor had held my hand the entire way. And then I get to step 8 and step 9, and this sponsor is not going to go out into the world and make these amends with me. And so I had learned how to trust my sponsor. I was beginning to learn how to trust this process and a power greater than myself that I was cultivating a relationship with. But it was somewhere halfway through my amends that I realized not that the 9th step promises had come true, that I began to trust God because I had so much fear associated with making the amends. Now, I shared briefly with you about my father and how that experience unfolded. When I got sober, and this is not an exaggeration, I have my 8th step list with me if anybody would like to see it after the session is over. I had in the ballpark 230 people and institutions that I had harmed over the course of my life. I started running roughshod over life and the people and the world when I was around 14 or 15 years old. I got clean when I was 31 years old. That is 17 years of ripping and running. So I hurt a lot of people. Now, the first 8-step list I made in those first few months only had about 150. But what happened is I got really involved in making amends, and I was going to a lot of meetings. Man, I can't tell you how many meetings I did in my first year, but I can tell you I did over 180 meetings in my first 90 days. And as I sat and listened in meetings, I sometimes would hear people talk about experiences, and I'd be like, damn, I got to add them to my 8-step list because it reminded me of something. So my list grew. So if you were to ask me to look at it after the session, you will see where it's the first list is typed out, and then there's a bunch of stuff that's handwritten in. Of those 230, and this is a guess, I approached all 230. I made an attempt to contact them. I would say somewhere between 40 and 50 never responded to my attempt to contact them. Okay? I'd say about another 30 to 40 said, "No thanks, have a nice life. I can't believe you still think about stuff, man. Move on with your life." Well, fuck you, I never want to talk to you again. I did, and please forgive my language, but that's exactly, screw you, I don't want to talk to you, have a nice life. But a lot of people were willing to see me. I had some emotional amends experiences that people really handed it to me, but I never had anyone spit in my face or throw me out of the office or throw me out of their home or throw me out of the restaurant we were meeting at or the Starbucks that we met at. Now, Brandon, he'll probably talk about it. He refers to what's called the, I think, maybe it's not Brandon, I can't remember. Somebody I know refers to there's these set of amends called the tornado amends, right? Because in the big book, they talk about the tornado roaring through the lives of others. And the tornado amends are the people that are closest to you. They get clipped by the tornado immediately. Mom, dad, sisters, brothers, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, best friends, employers. Those are difficult amends. They're emotional. But they're not the ones that had the most fear associated with them. In all amends in general, the reason there's the statement that's true about the miracle of 6 and 7 happens in the actions of steps in 8 and 9, making all these amends, when you look in someone's eyes and you can see by the look in their eyes what your selfish and inconsiderate lifestyle does to